You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Thursday the 30th of December 2021 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming live today at radioalbion.com because we have with us geopolitical analyst Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson from rustjournal.org. Matt, good day, sir. Have you had a good couple of days off? Are you enjoying the Western Christmas season?
Yeah, you know, Santa visited me quite a bit this year. He was very good to me. I'm kind of happy to see this year go. I think 2022 is going to be my year.
Yes, we got New Year's Eve tomorrow, and I know there are quite a few of us hoping that 2022 is going to be a better year for us. Perhaps we will see peace between Ukraine and Russia. That's something that I would very much like to see. And today's episode is going to be about Western self-delusion about Ukraine. And this is particularly about an ex-Swedish prime minister who has been sticking his nose into affairs between Russia and Ukraine. And we have an editorial today, which is basically talking about that. This editorial is for RT. It's by a Tarik Cyril Amar, a Turkish historian who specializes in the Cold War. And you picked this out, Matt. Is there a particular reason? Have you heard of this guy before, this Tarik Cyril Amar? Is that somebody that you're aware of?
No, I've never heard of him. But because this is something that I say all the time, and some of these examples that he mentions I've used before, I really liked it. I mean, no one's making the obvious point that foreign policy, including warfare, is being made by people who know nothing about the area. It's really easy to construct an enemy, to project all your psychological problems onto someone else if you don't know that much about them. It's almost an extreme version of Johnson's law, where, you know, policymakers can dehumanize a group of people that they know nothing about. If they were down the street, it would be different. But Russia is such a black hole in the American and Western European mentality, especially the American mentality. There's this vague feeling of dread concerning that. You know, China's the same way. That you could create these straw men and have them very easily believed and then base policy on it, including warfare.
Well, that's very true. I mean, even in Europe, you think Russia is just on the other side of Finland. You know, it's not that far away, and yet we don't have connections to it. We know very little about it. Well, this editorial from Tarik Cyril Amar, he begins by saying, with Ukraine again at the forefront of a recent peak in tensions between Russia and the West, the former Swedish Prime Minister Carl Bildt has pitched in onto the debate, condemning Moscow and calling for the West to toughen up. For those familiar with his hawkish politics, so far so predictable, but taking a closer look is still worthwhile because Bildt's assertions are not unique and are emblematic of a shop-worn repertoire that is increasingly popular among neo-Cold War hardliners. Bildt was once also a key figure in shaping the EU's policies in Eastern Europe, including those that led to the current confrontation with Russia over Ukraine, as well as being a frequent commentator and think tank chair with a good deal of influence. The former politician's glaring factual errors, and it seems self-serving biases, represent more than his own shortcomings. Instead, the fact that he gets away with them so well points to systemic problems in Western policymaking and public debate. Bildt's output is a useful indicator of flaws in Western thinking. Understanding them could help avoid confusion and apoplexy between East and West. I see this is exactly what you're pointing out there, that this guy gets away with this because people don't understand what's really going on here. Have you heard of this guy before, this Swedish Prime Minister? I mean, it says here that he's been interfering quite a bit up until now with after the Cold War. Do you know much about him, Matt?
Yeah, I've read a few things by him in the past. He was initially the foreign minister until 2014, and then but prior to that, he was prime minister in the early 90s, and he was the one who negotiated the European Union accession for Sweden. And then he was also the EU's envoy to Yugoslavia and to the Balkans. He was a UN special envoy to the Balkans, and he was even a part of the Dayton Peace Conference. He's the co-chair of the European Council on Foreign Relations. So the guy couldn't be any more establishment. So what he's saying here, and that's one of the, you know, I've read a lot worse essays on Ukraine and Russia before. But because he's so influential, because he's had a part in crafting the disasters over there, especially in the Balkans, when he writes, he's writing now to calm himself. He's justifying his own policies. And the only way to justify his own policies is to make Russia look monstrous. And that's the case for a lot of people. A lot of people who were in power in the 90s, early 2000s, today, they're simply justifying what they did. And to justify it, they have to paint this picture. But because you have mass ignorance, they could say whatever they want. I'm not sure if that works, whether or not he actually has cognitive dissonance in his mind, or if he's just a sociopath, like so many of them are. But all he's doing here is justifying the policies that he helped put together, especially when it comes to the EU.
He's just lying to himself, basically, and getting away with it because nobody else knows any better. His most recent intervention has come in long form via an editorial with Project Syndicate and in a shorter version on Twitter. In both cases, he has managed to frame an astonishing number of things inaccurately. On Twitter, Bilt has asserted that the Putin narrative on 2014 is, of course, all wrong. And he then offers his own take. What happened in Kiev was that President Viktor Yanukovych just fled the country. He could have stayed and respected the agreement he had signed, and then events followed the letter of the Ukrainian constitution and the agreement. Clearly, Bilt is alluding to the final phase of the clash between Yanukovych's government and protesters that took place between late November 2013 and late February 2014. As is well known, Yanukovych did flee. Yet Bilt's assertion that he could just have stayed is flat wrong. In reality, whatever your position on Yanukovych's behaviour when in power, full disclosure, abysmal in my view, it is a fact that at that point he was in physical danger and did not have a realistic option of simply abiding by the agreement, as Bilt falsely maintains. Now, this is quite a while back. We're talking 6 or 7 years ago here, Matt. So can you refresh our memories of what happened here with Yanukovych and what's being referred to?
Yanukovych was the head of Ukraine just before the war in eastern Ukraine. He was beleaguered. He was under attack both from the West and some of the fragments of his own population. There was an agreement for Ukraine to join the EU, which he rejected for a whole bunch of reasons and wanted to join the Russian customs union instead. The West then stirred up violence. And within a relatively short time, he was forced to flee the country. I was shocked at the violence of the rioters. I'd never seen anything like that before. The fact that the police weren't really fighting back. The fact that I don't think these protesters were aware of what they were fighting for. I'm pretty sure fighting for the EU was not on the agenda. Then I read that the American embassy was passing out essentially crystal meth, powerful stimulants to the protesters that even John McCain admitted. So they were able to go all night and not feel as much pain. So it was absolutely vicious. So these riots eventually drove Yanukovych out of the country, which was, you know, and of course the official argument is that it was because they were so desperate to join the European Union and become part of the Western economic space that they were willing to use that kind of violence. And it turns out that's not the case at all. You had various militias from the so-called left, the so-called right, all being, you know, organized by foreign forces. And no one, there certainly was no protest to join the EU. I don't think that's ever happened. The opposite usually happens. This was an artificial, extreme use of violence in the city of Kiev. And the agenda of the protesters really wasn't all that clear. The last thing it was any kind of a nationalist agenda. I'm the only one who's done an English language paper on Yanukovych's political ideas. And the last thing he wanted was that. He certainly made mistakes. It's not abysmal. I don't agree with him on that. But he certainly made some errors. But any executive in Ukraine is going to be desperate when the country just continues to fall more and more into third world status. But under Yanukovych, things were slowly beginning to turn around. So when he was removed from power, the oligarchs took over directly. This is when the eastern provinces, the Donbass, seceded and the war began. But the new government that came in, they rewrote the laws, they rewrote the constitution, they did everything they could, had failed miserably in every respect.
Well, I remember at the time, I mean, it was nationalist rioters. This was the bizarre thing. They thought that they were going to have a nationalist state there in Ukraine, yet they were being funded by America. They were taking wages from America. So the far right of the Ukraine was used to basically hand the country over to the EU and get rid of a more conservative, traditionalist-minded regime that they had. I mean, it is always better the devil you know. They didn't have gay pride parades in the middle of Kiev before this uprising, this rioting that took place. So Yanukovych was definitely in fear for his life. There's no way that he could have stayed there. So that's the that's the first lie that's basically being told here. And then this journalist, he continues, he says, "This is no minor point, because the former Swedish foreign minister doesn't only misrepresent Yanukovych's situation. He also implicitly embellishes the actions of the former president's opponents. In reality, a significant and, as it turned out, decisive faction of the protesters, led by the militant far right, chose not to accept the compromise that had been reached with the help of France, Germany, Poland, and Russia. Yanukovych may well have had other reasons to flee too, but it is clear that Bildt simply omits the role that the president's opponents played in deliberately sabotaging an agreement that could have allowed Ukraine to overcome Yanukovych's regime in a peaceful transition. The blueprint existed and had been accepted by all sides involved. It was trashed by both a faction of the protesters and Yanukovych." And obviously this was trashed because America wanted it trashed. I mean, that's what they were doing with the far right there, basically, getting them involved and trashing it. They didn't want there to be this peaceful transition. But what I'm interested in is it says here that there was this blueprint that existed and had been accepted by all sides involved. So what blueprint are they referring to there, Matt?
Well, I remember at the time I kind of snickered at it. But the agreement goes like this. He was to resign. Before then, he was going to repeal laws that the left didn't like. He was going to have early elections. Then the parliament had a special session, and they were going to bring back the 2004 constitution within a couple of days, because that constitution severely curtailed the power of the president and strengthened the parliament, which is a very bad idea. So prior to that, the head of state was appointed by the head of government and ministers. But the 2004 constitution had the exact opposite. That way, a new prime minister could also sign the association agreement with the EU, and Yanukovych's signature wouldn't be necessary. In other words, it gave the oligarchs a tremendous amount of power. It was essentially getting what the rioters wanted without having to use violence anymore. And of course, the rioters rejected it. They said it was window dressing. They said it was nonsense. This was, you know, the right sector said something like that. You know, they had their maximum demands. But groups like the right sector, and you have a lot of very suspicious characters in the so-called far right movements. You know, I wrote a whole book. One of the reasons I wrote my book on Ukrainian nationalism was to attack the claim that these rioters were nationalists at all. Ukrainian nationalism traditionally is extremely hostile towards liberalism and the West and capitalism, never trusting the U.S. But these people were fighting for an EU association agreement. This doesn't make any sense. And if, you know, and I could never find it. There's some other agenda here other than this, and I could never find it. So these people were, you know, were no more nationalist than Bildt is. So the whole thing was bizarre, but that's how it was being reported in the press. There are no neo-Nazis there. That's the pro-Russian position always mentions that. And that's certainly not been the policy of the government whatsoever. They became a satrapy of the West, third world status, exporting only raw materials, seeing its functional industry either destroyed or melted down. And that's why I say now, despite having the most educated population in the world per capita, they're now fourth world.
Well, I remember there was a lot of nationalist imagery that was used. There was a lot of national socialist imagery. And then mixed in with that, there was just a lot of hateful stuff. Like there was a misanthropic division, which just means that they hate all men. I mean, what does that have to do with nationalism, hating mankind? You know, just ridiculous things like that. I think I think it really didn't do nationalism a favor. It portrayed us all in a terrible light, basically. Yeah. And I can see that in a country like that, America will fund what they see as the neo-Nazis, and then in the West, you know, Russia will fund the Antifa to try and, you know, subvert the country. And this is why Navalny is funded by the West in Russia, and he's seen as a neo-Nazi over there. So our establishments and our governments, it's not above them to fund nationalist organizations in other countries. It's just they don't want nationalism in our countries. Well, one can only speculate why Bildt gets something so clear so wrong. Is he still reluctant to recognize the full and detrimental influence of Ukraine's far right? Is he incapable of accepting that his side also contributed to the violence of the Ukrainian regime change and its aftermath? Bildt's claim that afterwards the Ukrainian constitution was flawlessly observed is also factually wrong. In reality, it is common knowledge among those in favour of the changes as well that once the agreement had been sunk, the constitution could not be observed to the letter. Instead, the Ukrainian parliament used a highly creative set of moves to officially deprive Yanukovych of his post that stretched strict legality beyond breaking point. In similar situations, such ruptures are not unusual, and at that moment, there may have been no realistic alternative left. It is all the more astonishing to find Bildt in simple denial of a reality he could try to justify, but ought not to simply falsify. So he's sort of implying here that Ukraine still has the same constitution that it always had. So what's the truth of this matter, Matt?
Well, there's one Ukrainian constitution, and that was passed in 1996 in June. Now, in 2004, that was amended to change the system, as I already mentioned, which gives more parlor to the Rada, or the parliament, which is where the oligarchical state really has its seat. Yanukovych did everything he could to reverse that, and when he was overthrown, it was reinstated. But the constitution doesn't mean a whole lot, because politics is a lot less significant than economics. Political parties are named after oligarchs. They're their personal, kind of like what NGOs are. They're the personal representative of a certain oligarchic clan or corporation, or even a sector of the economy like aluminum. So politics, where power lay, is not really important. They'll justify anything. The minute that Yanukovych was overthrown, they rewrote the criminal law so as to release the prisoners that have been in prison due to corruption. Yulia Tymoshenko is chief among them. So they simply did whatever they wanted. Following the constitution, it's not like this constitution is an ancient institution. You know, it was passed in 96. There's no real sacredness to it. An oligarchy really doesn't care about law. They care about using law for their own purposes. So the constitution really isn't all that significant in these issues.
Well, it was probably thought up in quite a hurry as well at the dissolving of the Soviet Union, I would have thought. Well, much longer than his misleading tweet, Bildt's recent piece for Project Syndicate also features oddly obvious errors. Let's look at three examples of them. The most flagrant misrepresentation is his contention that a recent essay by Russian President Vladimir Putin on the historical relationship between Russia and Ukraine amounts to a call for a greater Slavic empire. The essay is available, in English as well, on the website of the Russian Foreign Ministry. Much of it is open to argument, obviously. Putin's principal argument that Ukrainians and Russians are really one people included. Full disclosure, I disagree. But there is no call for anything remotely like a Slavic empire, neither explicitly nor implicitly. Bildt is talking strictly nonsense here. That matters because in today's world we have enough genuine disagreements. There is no need to add more by misunderstanding and misrepresenting each other's view, whether by mistake or deliberately. Now, it seems to me that he's referring to the Russian Federation as a Slavic empire there, which, I mean, I look at it as sort of like a Slavic empire. Obviously, it includes some people that aren't Slavs, but Russia is the head nation in it. And is he sort of implying here that it's an ethno-national empire that he's talking about? Is he simply using poetic license there? I mean, a Slavic empire doesn't sound too bad to me. I mean, we have essentially a white Anglo-Saxon empire, don't we? White Anglo-Saxon Protestants, America. So what is the problem if he does want to have a Slavic empire? What is being talked about here, Matt?
Well, it's a psychological projection. You realize that the West does have a capitalist empire. It's not racial or anything by any means, but it is a corporatocracy. Given his role in destroying Slavic economies and in the Balkans and everything else, he has to make the claim then that, well, if I didn't do what I did, there would be this massive empire and they would take Europe. This is an overly emotional, almost an outburst. I've read the article. It's a long article that Putin put together. It's a historical article. I may do my next TON on it. It's very interesting. It shows you he is an intellectual in a lot of important ways. I disagree with certain aspects of it. They're related peoples. They're closely related peoples. They should be working together, but in no way is Putin talking about any kind of an empire. Since Ukraine declared independence, the Russian government has been assisting it in every way, including subsidizing gas. They were subsidizing gas even when the Ukrainian government was attacking Russia. They certainly have an interest in a growing Ukrainian economy because it's one of Russia's main trading partner. So, but the article was actually very moderate. The article was deeply historical. I should do my next TON on it. But this is, you know, this goes back to his own actions. It's like the Ukrainian government saying that there's going to be a Russian invasion any day. So it justifies their shutting down Russian media and forcing the Ukrainian language on people. He's saying that, you know, my support for liberalism all these years in the 90s, as a UN special envoy, etc., was a great thing because if I didn't do that, maybe the Slavic Empire would have come sooner. And this is what we need to fight. So it's one liberal empire worried about their number one nightmare, and that is a legitimate Slavic empire. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. But this is just, in this case, this is just to get people thinking that this is some kind of crazy conqueror.
Would you say that the Russians and the Ukrainians, it's rather like the English and the Scots? I mean, the English and the Scots are very close. They're a slightly different breed, but they're, you know, from the same island, basically. And I guess the Scots do have a language of their own, which is very different to English. But isn't Ukrainian very close to Russian? I mean, two questions there, really, Matt, for you to answer.
Yeah, you know, I've been asked that because I could read both okay. I would say there's about, I've said in the past, 60% overlap. I'd say about 70, 75% overlap. The two nations did develop differently, but they're both typified by orthodoxy and a strong sense of nationalism. Russia had definitely done wrong to Ukraine over the years, but only after the St. Petersburg Empire was formed. And of course, the Soviet Union was about as Russian as I am. And so they can't blame a Soviet Russia. It was a complete misnomer. Some Ukrainians have told me over the years that it's more like French and Italian. I think that may be too extreme. Some people have said Germany and Austria, which might be too close, but there are two different dialects there. And even the Belarusian language is very different from both, but they're all Slavic. They both use the same Cyrillic alphabet. And again, with about 70% overlap, and that includes most day-to-day terms. They are brother people, and maybe the English Scot connection is probably the best one.
Well, thanks. That really does help. Well, Bill also serves up an old red herring, claiming in essence that NATO cannot stop expanding without infringing on the sovereignty of non-NATO states. His argument is that the latter presupposes those states' right to achieve membership. Like so many others, he is badly confused. NATO, as a matter of fact, accepts new members only by choice, through unanimous consent of the old members. It is, in other words, a self-selecting club. That fact obviously clashes with the bizarre but popular idea that any non-member state has a right to be admitted, usually vaguely confused with the right to apply, as if the two were really the same in practice. In reality, what we can logically say about sovereignty and NATO is actually the following. Every non-member state may have a sovereign right to apply to become a member, but as the old members together have the right to reject the application, the right to apply and the right to become a member are clearly two very different things. In fact, one could make a more convincing argument that the sovereignty of already existing NATO members is infringed when commentators like Bildt deny their right to say no to new admissions individually or in principle. And this sounds a little bit to me as if he's sort of blaming NATO for appearing to be a more preferable partner to Russia, to countries like Ukraine, Romania and the rest of them. I mean, you can't get away from it. They are trying to join NATO. I mean, Romania has already joined them, and you could say, well, it's their sovereign right to join NATO. What has it got to do with Russia to say that they shouldn't be able to join NATO? I know it's an awkward issue because they don't want NATO's weapons right on the border of Russia. But I mean, it does seem to me as if they're sort of blaming NATO for this, and it's not really NATO's fault. Am I wrong in thinking that, Matt? What are your thoughts on this?
You know, I've mentioned this before, but for Ukraine, it still has the old Soviet model of armament and even the order of battle and training methods and everything else. To go to NATO would be to turn the entire military upside down. Now, it behaves very poorly. It functioned poorly in the Civil War in the East. In fact, most soldiers deserted rather than fight other Ukrainians. And many of them didn't accept this new government that took over. It would cost billions and billions and billions to shift all of the weaponry and the training and the officer corps to Western models. Now, Romania hasn't really even done that. But the point is to bring them into NATO even without that kind of shift, just to, you know, stick it to Russia, just to have an excuse to put weaponry in Ukraine, which would be, talk about just a warmongering move. But on paper anyway, to join NATO, just like when they were trying to join the EU, or you had a faction trying to join the EU, having to completely upend the military would cost more than 10 yearly budgets of Ukraine to do. If they don't switch over, then being a member of NATO is just symbolic. I don't believe that the Western European political or economic system is particularly popular in Ukraine. The only reason that the revolutionary government, the revolutionary liberal, I always call it the bankers' revolution in 2014, the only reason that government wants to do it is that if they just, you know, make a claim of a Russian invasion, NATO would then be obligated to come to their defense. That's really all that is. They're trying to have a signature that says we can do whatever we want because if Russia does anything in its own self-defense, we can use NATO against them. And this has come up before. But to have weaponry in Ukraine is a direct attack on Russia, and it's surrounding it with more weapons than already exists. It is an act of war, and Russia would be right to react.
So essentially, it's extremely irresponsible of NATO to accept these states because it does mean putting weapons right on the border of Russia, and Russia doesn't have weapons right on the border with America. I mean, it is irresponsible to be doing this. Finally, Bildt maintains that Putin has abandoned further dialogue with Ukraine's leaders. That is a statement that suffers from what seems a deliberate lack of context. In fact, Russia has explained its position repeatedly. It is no longer willing to accept two things. The first of those is that Ukraine's leaders systematically sabotage the implementation of the Minsk II agreement and the Steinmeier formula. That is the already existing path to peace, which Ukraine has actually signed up to. And second, that Western leaders keep letting Ukrainian leaders get away with this transparent tactic. Again, Bildt may disagree with Moscow's view. He may support Kiev's obstructionism, but simply pretending that Moscow's policies have no reason behind them except for Putin's personal moods is dishonest and useless. It only muddies the waters when real dialogue requires clarity as well as the ability to recognise one's own agency and responsibility. In sum, Bildt's recent intervention regarding Ukraine, Russia and the West is largely demagogic. Bildt represents what is already a bad tradition among Western neo-cold warriors. Sloppy with the facts and clearly selective and biased in the presentation of them, he does not simply leave things out. His main aim seems to be mobilizing and point scoring. He is, in other words, what the Soviets used to call a fighter on the ideological front. Just this time for a West grown complacent on its own post-Cold War unilateralism. It is time to leave this dated way of thinking behind. And I'm sure you agree with that sentiment, Matt. What are your final thoughts on all of this today?
Well, referring to this as a Cold War mentality is false. I largely think the war against the USSR was a myth. There were no sanctions on the Soviet Union. They were trying to rip Ukraine away and put missiles there. You had a huge anti-war movement, anti-nuke movement throughout Western Europe. You have none of that today. It's because Russia has a more or less nationalist state that Ukraine would have had a nationalist state had the 2004-2014 events not occurred. That's why it's happening this way. That's why the threats are so extreme. None of these threats existed during the Cold War at all. This is a totally different thing. Marxism was never the problem in the Cold War. It was the fact that Russia and China can grow so large as to push the U.S. dollar out. That was the only concern. But it had nothing to do with Marxism. This is an ideological war. And again, because Bildt had a minor role in crafting a lot of the policies that led to this destruction, he now needs to make Putin out to be a monster in order to justify what he's done. Johnson's law is at work here. He's painting a picture that few people could actually ever reject because they don't know enough. They don't know what happened in 2004, 2014, who was in the right, who was in the wrong. And they certainly don't know that Ukraine today is a colony of the United States and the EU that's being run from the embassy. And that politics and constitutions really don't matter. 2014 was about the oligarchy melting down the country to pay off debt, to asset strip and go live elsewhere. And to create the new Khazaria in Odessa as the plan still exists. That was the whole point of 2014. But no one in the West knows that. No one in the West even has the apparatus to understand that.
Well, the more people listen to Radio Albion, the more they will find out the truth about this situation. And thank you very much for coming on today, Matt. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We have a Radio Albion roundtable for you tomorrow, and I will be back on Monday with more of the Daily Nationalist for you. God bless and hail victory.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.